All right, it is time for us to get started this evening. I was hoping I could make it through class without that, and can't make it 5 seconds without coughing. I initially thought we were going to do Numbers 23 tonight and Numbers 24 next time, and the more I got into them, the more I said we need to cover these two together. It's really a single unit of text, and so we'll look at both of these. Obviously, that means we can't slow down and do a ton of detail, but that's okay because it's the same thing being repeated three times with a little bit of additional stuff the last time. So we'll kind of do some big picture overview stuff here at the beginning, see the pattern that's going on, talk about the big picture of these blessings that Balaam is pronouncing upon Israel, and then we'll look at some of the details of that are unique to each of these oracles. And if we have time, I'll share a couple of just kind of reflections that I had as I worked through this. So that's kind of where we're headed tonight. Let's begin with a prayer. Our good Father, we're thankful to you that you are a God who does indeed bless your people, that you have called us and you have chosen us to be yours. And with that comes the protection that you provide as our shield and fortress around us. And that whatever may happen in this life, we know that in the end, nothing can harm us if we are on your side. And so help us to remain faithful to you, to remain safely in your hands and in your blessing. Help us tonight as we study that we would know you better and know your word better so that we can live better lives in service to you. In your Son we pray. Amen. All right. Well, I showed you this last time, which is kind of the overall big picture of this entire section of the Balaam narrative here in Numbers 22 through 24. And it really breaks down to two sections of three. At least that's how I'm going to call it. That's what I've been calling it. So three encounters with God where Balaam seeks the Lord, and then Balaam seeks the Lord, and then the Lord appears to Balaam without him seeking. And then three oracles, depending on how you count, there's either three, four, or seven. But four through seven are all basically an appendix to three. So I'm sticking with as many other number threes as there are in the Balaam story. I'm sticking with three. So three oracles, and in the first two, again, Balaam seeks the Lord. In the last one, the language is different. The first two, Balaam seeks the Lord, and the Lord puts a word in his mouth. The last time, Balaam kind of turns to go somewhere, and the Spirit comes upon him. And so it does kind of fit this pattern of the Lord appearing in an unbidden sort of way this last time. And so we talked last week about these three encounters with God. And so today we'll talk about these three different oracles. And again, part of what makes this easy to work through this text is that all three of these attempts to curse Israel follow the same basic pattern. There are six different things that happen every single time. And so once you kind of see that basic pattern, you don't have to do a lot of explaining of it. You understand what's coming around next time. It's a lot of the same stuff. And there's a few unique details in each of those, but by and large, it's going to be the same thing. And so this is the general pattern of Balaam's oracles. First, King Balak brings Balaam to a high point or a mountain of some kind where he can have some view of Israel and look down on Israel. And that seems to be part of the desire or part of the plan to curse them, as they are within his line of sight as he is pronouncing this curse. And what happens next is that Balak will build seven altars and offer a bull and a ram on each of the altars. This is apparently a way of trying to catch God's attention and win his favor with these sacrifices. We'll talk a little bit more about that here in a second. What happens after this is Balaam tells Balak, "You stay here with the altars, and I will go elsewhere to seek God. And perhaps God will give me a word that I can speak." God does indeed give him a word to speak, and each time he comes back, he pronounces an extended poetic oracle of blessing upon Israel. Which, as you can imagine, Balak doesn't like. And so Balak will react negatively to the oracle, and his frustration seems to be increasing every single time, as you can expect that it might. Balak is here kind of what Balaam was on the donkey last time, just getting more and more frustrated every time things aren't going the way that he wants them to go. And I don't know that that's an intentional parallel as much as it's just human nature that, you know, you're trying to do something that's really important, and there are these obstacles and roadblocks every time you think you're getting somewhere, it doesn't happen. But he does seem to be increasing in his frustration. And then also, Balaam says that he can only speak what God says. And this is something that is, again, probably the most prevalent theme in this entire section. Let me jump back for a second. I'll put this back up on the screen. Going back to this, all six of these different scenes, there is a statement of some kind or another. It's worded slightly differently all the way through. But in each of these six scenes, there is a point where it is explicitly said that Balaam can only say what God wants him to say. So this is a constant theme through it, and we'll see it here in these oracles in this part of the text where Balaam will, again, say that he can only speak what the Lord says. So what I want to do very quickly is read through the oracles themselves. And after we do that, we'll kind of summarize some of the key points. Then we'll kind of go back through and look at them in a little bit more detail. And I'm not sure if this is the best way to do this or not, but you need a better teacher is the answer. Picking up in chapter 23 and verse 7, Balaam took up his discourse and said, "From Aram, Balak has brought me, the king of Moab, from the eastern mountains. Come, curse Jacob for me, and come, denounce Israel. How can I curse whom God has not cursed? How can I denounce whom the Lord has not denounced? For from the top of the crags I see him, from the hills I behold him. Behold, a people dwelling alone and not counting itself among the nations. Who can count the dust of Jacob? Or number the fourth part of Israel? Let me die the death of the upright, and let my end be like his." And I'll go ahead and read verses 11 and 12. Balak said, "What have you done to me? I took you to curse my enemies, and behold, you've done nothing but bless them." And he answered, "Must I not take care to speak only what the Lord puts in my mouth?" And so they go to the second place. And we'll come back to some more details here in a minute. But Balaam took up his discourse, verse 18, and said, "Rise, Balak, and hear, give ear to me, O son of Zippor. God is not a man that he should lie, or a son of man that he should change his mind. Has he said, and will he not do it? Or has he spoken, and will he not fulfill it? Behold, I received a command to bless. He has blessed, and I cannot revoke it. He is not beheld misfortune in Jacob, nor has he seen trouble in Israel. The Lord their God is with them, and the shout of a king is among them. God brings them out of Egypt, and is for them like the horns of the wild ox. For there is no enchantment against Jacob, no divination against Israel. Now it shall be said of Jacob and Israel, what has God wrought? Behold, a people. As a lioness, it rises up, and as a lion, it lifts itself. It does not lie down until it has devoured the prey and drunk the blood of the slain." And Balak said to Balaam, "Do not curse them at all, and do not bless them at all." But Balaam answered Balak, "Did I not tell you all that the Lord says that I must do?" And then chapter 24 and verse 3, he took up his discourse and said, "The oracle of Balaam the son of Beor, the oracle of the man whose eye is opened, the oracle of him who hears the word of God, who sees the vision of the Almighty, falling down with his eyes uncovered. How lovely are your tents, O Jacob, your encampments, O Israel, like palm groves that stretch afar, like gardens beside a river, like aloes that the Lord has planted, like cedar trees beside the waters. Waters shall flow from his buckets, and his seed shall be in many waters. His king shall be higher than Agag, and his kingdom shall be exalted God brings him out of Egypt and is for him like the horns of the wild ox. He shall eat up the nations, his adversaries, and shall break their bones in pieces and pierce them through with his arrows. He crouched, he lay down like a lion, and like a lioness, who will rouse him up? Blessed are those who bless you, and cursed are those who curse you. And Balak's anger was kindled against Balaam, and he struck his hands together. And Balak said to Balaam, I called you to curse my enemies, and behold, you have blessed them these three times. Therefore now flee to your own place. I said, I will certainly honor you, but the Lord has held you back from honor. Balaam said to Balak, did I not tell your messengers whom you sent to me? If Balak should give me his house full of silver and gold, I will not be able to go beyond the word of the Lord, to do either good or bad of my own will. What the Lord speaks, that I will speak. Now behold, I am going to my people. Come, I will let you know what this people will do to your people in the latter days. And he took up his discourse and said, the oracle of Balaam the son of Beor, the oracle of the man whose eye is opened, the oracle of him who hears the words of God and knows the knowledge of the Most High, who sees the vision of the Almighty falling down with his eyes uncovered. I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. A star shall come out of Jacob, and a scepter shall rise out of Israel. It shall crush the forehead of Moab. It shall break down all the sons of Sheth. Edom shall be dispossessed. Seir also, his enemies, shall be dispossessed. Israel is doing valiantly. And one from Jacob shall exercise dominion and destroy the survivors of the cities. Then he looked on Amalek and took up his discourse and said, Amalek was the first among the nations, but its end is utter destruction. And he looked on the Kenite and took up his discourse and said, enduring is your dwelling place, and your nest is set in the rock. Nevertheless, Cain shall be burned when Asher takes you away captive. And he took up his discourse and said, alas, who shall live when God does this? But ships shall come from Kittim and shall afflict Asher and Eber, and he too shall come to utter destruction. Then Balaam rose and went back to his place, and Balak also went his way. All right, so what I want to do here is, in just a second, ask you if there's anything that stood out to you about these. But before we get too far removed from seeing the big picture of this, what I would emphasize is that the blessings in general could be grouped into three different sorts of blessings. And that is that they speak to how God has blessed Israel in the past, making reference to the promise to Abraham a couple of times, making reference to the Exodus from Egypt a couple of times, talking about how he has given them his own strength to defend them in a few places, and how he chose them over all the nations to be his special people. All of that terminology is not used exactly that way, but the ideas are all there. So in the past, God has blessed them. And you could also look at these oracles and see how God is blessing them in the present. In particular, that he dwells in their midst, and as a result, there is no misfortune or trouble, and there can be no enchantment or divination against them, because God is in their midst as their protector, and so he is blessing them presently as well. Anyone want to guess what's next? Any prophets among us who can foretell the future? Yes, God will bless them in the future. Good guess, everybody. And so here you get in this final section, the appendix to the third oracle, or the fourth oracle, or the fourth through seventh oracles, you get some detailed discussion of their abundant produce and their abundant progeny and the defeat of Agag and the Amalekites and some other smaller nations as well. And depending on what you do with Asher, either another small nation or even the grand nation of Assyria, that's a little bit hard to be exact about. And then also that there will be this great king that will rule over them and defeat their enemies. And so you get the idea of kingship in the future here in this as well. So that's kind of the big picture of these blessings. Now, obviously, there's a lot of specifics in the midst of all of that, but this is the general idea, or at least one way of looking at the general idea of the blessings that Balaam is discussing in these oracles. So before we kind of go back through this and look in a little bit more detail, thoughts or questions or comments, anything that stands out to you in Balaam's oracles that you think is worth mentioning? Oh, verse 24, verse 7. Yeah. Yeah, no, that's fine.
Okay. Is that in reference to 1 Samuel 15?
That's how most people I've read understand it, and I don't know any other Agag that it could be a reference to. This would be, I mean, all of this is talking about, you know, the military exploits and victories of Israel, and that is an incredibly significant moment in the narrative. Amalek was a potent enemy to, you know, to reckon with, and so this very famous king, you know, the one of the few named kings of the Amalekites that we have later on. Either it is a direct specific prophecy about Israelites' fight with Agag, the king of Amalek, or I have no idea what it's about. So,
and if that's the case, Haman being an Agagite, is that going to be more of a reference to this prophecy than even necessarily the 1 Samuel passage?
So Haman the Agagite, there's obviously a connection in the Esther story to 1 Samuel 15, because Mordecai is a descendant of Kish as well, so you've kind of have that on both sides. The question that we can't answer with any certainty is whether it's the same Kish and the same Agag.
Right.
Obviously, within the story, it's written that way to emphasize that connection, so you read it in light of that, whether they're literally relatives or not. So since we can't know for certain, I'd be cautious about pressing this verse too hard into Esther, but it's certainly, I mean, especially if Haman the Agagite is a direct descendant of King Agag, and the book of Esther is the final chapter of that grand conflict, then yeah, this would tie into that as well. Jonathan?
There's a lot of animal imagery.
There is. Yeah. There.
I don't have any.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, no, that's, and a lot of the animal imagery is, I just didn't know if there was going to be more to follow that. So, a lot of the animal imagery is tied up in their victory or God's protection of them. In particular, the lion imagery, you know, God crouching down and protecting his people. God is like an ox's horns for them. And so you're thinking the strength of the animal is the analogy for how God is protecting his people. It's not all of that, but a fair amount of the animal imagery, I think that's the last time I have to say that, is wrapped up in that. Greg?
Balak seems to be a glutton for punishment. He kept, you know, Balaam told him, I'm only going to tell you what God tells me, and then he goes on and keeps stabbing him with his blessings and curses.
Yeah.
And then at the end, Balak blames God for it. Balaam's not going to interfere.
Yeah, you wonder what's going through his head through all of this. I mean, at first, oh yeah, sure, Balaam, I know you're only going to say what God wants you to say, but, you know, we know how to manipulate the gods by offering the right sacrifices, but then it doesn't work. And so the second time, notice this is one of the things we were going to come back to in a minute, but since we're on this, we'll talk about it now. Chapter 23 and verse 13, Balak said, please come with me to another place from which you may see them. You shall only see a fraction of them, and you shall not see them all. Then curse them for me from there. And again, we're not told exactly what's, you know, spinning in his head at this moment, but the impression I get is, okay, you can't curse them all, but if we reduce the quantity a little bit, maybe you can at least curse some of them. And so we'll, you know, it's, you know, one thing to eat, you know, the 5-pound cheeseburger at the restaurant challenge. You can't do that, but maybe you can at least eat the 1-pound, you know. That's a terrible analogy. but you get the idea, you know, reduce the quantity and maybe you can accomplish something. But no, that's not going to work either. And so then I don't know what he's up to the last time, but, you know, and even after the second time, he says, you know, don't say anything. Don't curse them and don't bless them. And what he means is just stop talking. And then he goes, all right, we'll go to place number three and try again. So, yeah, glutton for punishment. What's the old definition of insanity, right? Elizabeth? Okay. Anthony? Yeah, one of the interesting things about these oracles, especially the first two, is this like theology 101 for Balak. Okay, I understand you think the gods can be manipulated, and I understand you've never actually met a real god before that knows, you know, what's going on and can control things and do stuff. And so, you know, the way that these develop is, all right, Balak, this is what you called me to do, and this is what you asked me to do, but I cannot curse the one that God has not cursed. I cannot denounce the one that God has not denounced. God has made great promises to these people. That's just how it's going to be. And so Balak says, okay, let's try again. And then there is, you know, God's not a person that he should lie. He's not going to change his mind every 5 minutes. And then, you know, by the third time, there's less of that trying to get it through Balak's thick skull that, you know, God's not like us, and it's more of just what God is going to do for his people. Far from cursing them, he's going to bless them in all of these incredible sorts of ways. Tom?
Well, I hope about, too, not only are the gods manipulable, but people are, too.
And, yes.
You know, is this a negotiating tactic by, you know, Balak? Going back to Agag, of course, the subject even has Gog there, which is another. But, you know, it's kind of a mythical, legendary enemy, you know, that Ezekiel talks about. But if it is Agag, I mean, surely it's not the same Agag. Unless, like you say, it's direct prophecy.
Yeah.
He wouldn't be alive.
Yeah, he's not alive at this point.
If
so,
it's a, like a throne name, like Pharaoh or
Abimelech. Thought of that. That's an interesting thought. Well, yeah, sure. But a lot of places did have throne names, so it's not a crazy guess or anything. Colleen?
It is interesting thinking when you're just talking about the, that God cannot be manipulated because the false gods can, but the people can. So eventually, he learns.
Yeah, this is what one thing we'll loop back to at the end. And part of the question to me is, what exactly does this mean when it comes out of Balaam's mouth? But notice in chapter 23 and verse 10, after this reference back to the promise to Abraham, that the third line of verse 10, let me die the death of the upright and let my end be like his. I mean, if this is a sincere thought from Balaam after actually speaking with the living God, I want to die the death of the upright. You know, there's a path to that, and Balaam doesn't choose it. Where he is going to go is not to the death of the upright. He's going to go to the death of the wicked by the time all this is done. Like I said, we'll look back around to that in a little while, but that is an interesting thing to think about. You know, what Balaam is going to do is, I can't curse them, so I'll come up with a way to get them to curse themselves and sinning. And he winds up hanging out with the Midianites and getting killed by the sword among the Midianites. So definitely doesn't die the death of the upright.
It's also interesting that the way it's written here that altars and offerings were Balaam's idea. And, you know, Balak's just, it's comedic from our standpoint, this whole thing that Balak's offering to pay him all this money for doing everything that Balaam is saying. He's not, you know, coming up with this idea that, hey, how about, what if I made these offerings? Balaam is saying, hey, make these offerings and I'll see what happens.
Yeah.
He's just going along with this. It goes through this whole thing, just getting more frustrated. And then at the very end, they just part ways.
Yeah.
I mean, righteous prophets have been killed by kings of Israel for just saying, don't go to that war, you're going to die.
Right.
And Balaam's just stringing this guy along this whole way, and
yeah,
they just agree to part ways.
It's a really interesting, I mean, the psychology of this entire section of text is fascinating, and you really wish you had some insight into some of the things that they're thinking in the midst of all of this. I would say, well, let's work our way through these. I don't have anything special here. I just have the basic outline here. But we'll talk about some of the details here, and this is a good spot to make that transition, because one of the first things I was going to talk about are these altars and sacrifices that they're making in this context. Interestingly enough, there is a Babylonian tablet that's been discovered by archaeologists that talks about setting up seven altars and seven incense burners and the blood of seven sheep in order to get the attention of the gods. And you do this in the presence of the gods to get their attention. So the idea of setting up seven altars to catch the gods' catch their eye is not something that's unique to the book of Numbers. And so it may be that part of why Balaam is saying this is because this is how it works. And again, one of the open questions is Balaam a true prophet of God who is being wicked, or is Balaam a famous prophet for hire that God chooses to use to accomplish his own purposes? And the fact that Balaam is known outside the Bible in some inscriptions where he is a prophet of, was it Ashtar? I don't have it written down today. I think it was Ashtar that he's a prophet of. Would suggest that he's a pagan prophet, not a prophet of God. And so if he's been, you know, trying to get the gods' attentions for hire, and he's this, you know, famous prophet, everyone wants to get him because he's the best prophet at cursing people or whatever, he's used to doing this. This is part of what he does everywhere he goes. And so presumably that's part of what's going on here, and part of why that's happening is that this is the process of getting the attention of the gods. He probably just isn't used to an actual god talking to him. That would be the surprise to him in this moment. The other thing about these offerings that are worth noting is that this is very costly. Seven bulls and seven rams each time. So 21 of each, 42 total by the time he's done. And these are probably the most expensive animals that are offered anywhere in the Bible are bulls and rams. We're not talking about, you know, turtle dove and some grain. This is bulls and rams, large animals, major investments, a lot of food that's coming off of your table in order to do this. Which, you know, part of that is because you're trying to give your best to the gods. You're trying to get their attention. You're trying to buy their favor. I mean, if a person can be bought, why can't the gods be bought? That's kind of how they're thinking. And that's what happens when you create gods in man's image, is those gods will do what a man does. And that's why Balak has to be told, God's not a man. He's not a son of man. He doesn't act like people. So don't expect him to do this. And so that's part of the backdrop of all of that. But then also that Balaam goes to wherever he goes, and perhaps the Lord will come and meet me, he says. And God met Balaam. And notice in verse 5, the Lord put a word in Balaam's mouth and said, return to Balak, and thus you shall speak. And so he goes back and he speaks what God had told him to say. And then down in verse 12, Balaam says, must I not take care to speak what the Lord puts in my mouth? And so that phrasing of what God put in his mouth is used twice in this first one. And the idea is that he has no choice in what he's going to say. God has put this in his mouth. He must speak what God has put in his mouth to say. As to the oracle itself, it's really a pretty general message. And the message is that Balaam is not going to be able to do what God isn't going to allow him to do. And it's not just that God is capricious and won't let it happen. The issue is that these people have been blessed. And the ones that God has blessed cannot and will not be cursed. And it doesn't matter what Balak thinks or what Balak pays or who Balak calls to come curse these people. It's not going to happen, because he can't override God's blessing. And there are a couple of important points here as well. At the end of this, from the top of the crags I see him, that is the nation of Israel that he sees. From the hills I behold him. Behold, a people dwelling alone and not counting itself among the nations. The significance of that is they're not just among all the nations. They're not counted as among the nations. They're counted as God's people. They're not just one of the other nations. They're a people for God's possession, is who the Israelites are. They're not just like everybody else. They're distinct from everybody else, is the point. And then verse 10, who can count the dust of Jacob? That's an obvious reference to the Abrahamic promise that gets made a few times over the years. And so this is, you know, Abraham promise language that's showing up here in this first oracle. The second oracle, like we said already, he says, all right, this didn't work. Let's try again. We'll just go look at a few of them, and maybe you can curse a few of them if you can't curse all of them. And so he takes him to a field, the field of Zophim at the top of Pisgah, and built seven altars, and we go through all of that again. And Balaam says, stay here, buy your burnt offering, and I'll go over there and try to meet the Lord, and, you know, we'll see what he does. And God gives him a message to speak the second time as well. Again, the oracle is rooted in this criticism of Balak's theological presumptions. God can't be manipulated. I know what you think this is going to be because you've worked with all of these false gods all along and you work with people and you think if you pay Balaam enough, he'll do something. Therefore, if you pay God enough, he'll do something, you know, whatever it might be. God is not going to be manipulated like a person can be manipulated. And again, Israel is blessed. That was the message of the first oracle. The second oracle kind of ratchets that up a little bit because not only he has been blessed and I cannot revoke it there in verse 20, but notice in verse 21, the Lord their God is with them. Remember, kind of fundamental to the covenant itself is I will be your God, you will be my people, and I will dwell with you. God dwells in the camp. And that is seen, of course, in the tabernacle and the Ark of the Covenant there. The pillar of fire and the pillar of cloud. God dwells in the camp. And it doesn't matter what you think you're going to do. You're not going to pronounce any enchantment that's going to overthrow the power of God. You're not going to pronounce any divination that's going to overthrow the power of God. And so, you know, what this all boils down to is, Balak, I'm sorry, this is going to fail. You cannot change God's mind, and you certainly can't overpower God. It's not just they've been blessed a little bit. Maybe if you come up with enough curse potion, you can overpower that. No, God is there with them. And so then the last piece of this that's worth mentioning is this Exodus reference in verse 22. God brings them out of Egypt, and he is for them like the horns of the wild ox. And so the Exodus, I mean, throughout the Old Testament, the Exodus is the supreme demonstration of God's care for and fighting on behalf of his people. And that's what is always cited first and foremost. When someone wants to make the point that God fights for his people or God cares for his people or God chose his people or that they are God's special people, whichever one of those sorts of things it is, exhibit A is the Exodus always. So God brought them out of Egypt. He is for them like the horns of the wild ox, the strength of the animal, the part that, you know, you come across a wild ox, the number one part of that animal that you don't want to be anywhere near are its horns. Because that's the strength and the power of the animal. That's what fights its battles. That's what, you know, kills other animals or whatever else the case may be. So, and then this is going to be repeated almost verbatim, if not verbatim, in the third oracle as well. And so Balak's response is, it'd be better if you just shut up and not say anything. And of course, Balaam says again, I have to say what God tells me to say. And Balak says, well, we'll try again. Again, I'm not sure exactly what's going through his head. And so the third oracle, we have the same procedure, the same altars, the same everything. And this time, when Balaam saw that it pleased the Lord to bless Israel, he did not go, as at other times, to look for omens, but he set his face toward the wilderness. And Balaam lifted up his eyes and saw Israel camping tribe by tribe. So instead of going to look for, to see if God will send him a message, he just stands there and looks over the nation of Israel. And the Spirit of God came upon him. And he took up his discourse and said, and then we get this oracle. And this is no longer solely focused on God's relationship with his people and what God has done in the past for them. Now you're finding discussion of the future settlement in Canaan, the rise of the monarchy, victory over specific foes. Verses 6 and 7 kind of give us this picture of the land flowing with milk and honey. It's not the language that's used here, but palm groves that stretch afar, gardens beside a river, aloes that the Lord has planted, cedar trees beside the waters. All of this is this beautiful land they're going to inhabit. Verse 7 is either a reference to having plenteous water or perhaps plenteous offspring, depending on what you do with that imagery there, and whether it's using the same imagery as Proverbs 5 or it's more literally water. Either one would be seen as a great blessing for the people in the land, obviously, so the point is largely the same. Victory over Agag there in verse 7 that we've already talked about some already, but a key point of this. Again, verse 8 references the Exodus and the strength of God fighting for his people and how he just overthrows anyone that is in his way and that he's like a lion. He crouched, which is either, you know, after and he's going to lie down, but probably it's he crouched to pounce. And then after that, he lay down because the battle was over. And so like a lion or like a lioness, taking a nice nap in the sun or whatever, raise your hand if you want to go poke them. this is, you know, God fighting for his people. And so, again, a very strong image here as well. And so Balak's really angry, and he says, I've called you to curse my enemies, and behold, you've blessed them these three times. Go away. Just go away. I'm not paying you anything, is where this seems to be ending. So they're going to go their separate ways. Balak's going to let him go, but Balaam's not getting paid. And probably, you know, he'll get a bad Yelp review or something for his, you know, prophet services or whatever the ancient equivalent of that would be. Balak would let people know how terrible Balaam was in whatever way he could. But that doesn't end things, and so Balaam picks up yet again. And what you find here is, again, expansions and developments of the previous oracle, describing more fully the future of God's blessing, more specific victories that they are going to have. And again, some people see all of this as one fourth oracle. Some see it as 4, 5, 6, and 7. The last one's being very short. Of course, that gives us 7 oracles, and, you know, people get obsessed with the number 7. But that could have some significance here. But it really is just an expansion of the third oracle in a lot of ways. Probably the most significant verse in this, if I had to pick just one verse to focus on, would be verse 17. I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. A star shall come out of Jacob, and a scepter shall rise out of Israel. It shall crush the forehead of Moab and break down all the sons of Sheth, and then the other victories that will come as well. But this is very clearly speaking of the rise of a king. Like a star rises, a king will rise, and the scepter being one of the key images of kingship. A king is coming. And it reminds us that, you know, when God is upset about them wanting a king in Samuel, it's not because the whole king thing had never occurred to God before. You know, he was talking about kings to Abraham and Jacob and Judah. And in Deuteronomy, he's telling them how to live when they have a king. And here there's a king that's going to rise. I mean, the king thing, God's pretty well aware of that. He's known about it all along. Something different was the problem in Samuel's time. But so a king will rise. And again, you can't read anything in terms of kingship and a rising scepter and power and defeating enemies without asking if and how this has a messianic flavor to it as well. This is not a traditional, you know, top 20 list of messianic prophecies or anything, but this certainly fits a lot of those same ideas. Some people see the star rising, or the star shining out of Jacob, even as potentially being language that is intentionally echoed in the star over Bethlehem, where Jesus is born. That seems a little bit of a stretch to me, but that is the sort of thing that you'll see if you're doing reading on this text. As to the nations that are defeated, I guess one last thing that I'll say is some of these are more certain, others are less certain. The ones that we know. I mean, Amalek is Amalek, Edom is Edom, Moab is Moab. The Kenites we know pretty well. Asher is either a local tribe that has a similar name to that, or it's a reference to Assyria. And the question is whether this is just tribal squabbles, or this is escalating up to the point that even Assyria will fall before God. And either of those are legitimate readings of this. Sheth in verse 17, there's a guess or two, but we're not 100% sure who Sheth is. So again, we know some of these, we don't know some of them, and it's best not to get hung up on that. But at the end, Balaam leaves, and Balak leaves, and that seems to be the end of the Balaam story, until it's not. So we'll have to loop back around to that when we get there later on. So that's a little bit more of a run-through of some of the details of these oracles. Thoughts or questions about anything we've talked about, or anything I didn't talk about that you wanted to? Colleen? Yeah. 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 And even the end of the third oracle proper, in verse 9, blessed are those who bless you and cursed are those who curse you. There is, I mean, explicit quotation of part of the promise to Abraham in Genesis 12. And this is, again, how you know that the moment that Balak decided to curse Israel, he was done, because he has put himself in God's crosshairs at that point. And so this just is not going to work out well for him at all. And there's a reminder here as well. You know, you think about the entire nation down there has no idea any of this is going on. And it's a reminder of how many times, conceivably at least, God has protected us from things that we did not even know were dangers. You know, we think of all the ways God has delivered us in ways that we know, but how many ways has God delivered us that we are completely unaware of and may never be aware of? I mean, we like to think, oh, we'll find out about all of that in the next life. Maybe we will, maybe we won't. But one thing I'm certain of is that God is constantly protecting us from things that we're oblivious to. Greg? Yeah, that's a very simple but very profound and important point. That's for sure. Well, let me make a couple of other points kind of along these lines. We've kind of moved into, you know, application and theologizing and so forth. One thing that I came across as I thought about this was the idea of what we might call spiritual counterfeits. You know, in this case, it's a false conception of God and how you can manipulate the gods to do what you want. And I don't think most of us, I hope none of us are, you know, tempted to hire a prophet to curse our enemies, you know, or expect any sort of magic or voodoo to work against people in that sort of way. But there is a broader temptation towards spiritual counterfeits. And you see that in a couple of ways. I mean, you can't drive around Tampa without seeing, you know, psychic places and tarot cards and palm readings, and you know how many different documents get printed every day that has a horoscope for the day in it, and that is another sort of way of trying to exercise control over the future. That, I mean, it means nothing at all. It's, you know, roundly condemned in the Old Testament is a pagan way of thinking, and rightly so, because it is a pagan way of thinking. Most of us probably aren't interested in that either. But there are other kinds of spiritual counterfeits, you know, money and possessions, power and influence, people and relationships. And the problem with spiritual counterfeits, as you look at it here in Numbers, is threefold. First of all, they are just insanely expensive. 21 bulls and 21 rams, the costliest of all the animal sacrifices, plus the cost of sending envoys to get Balaam twice because he doesn't come back the first time, plus the feast when Balaam gets there, to say nothing of the fee that he thought he'd have to pay Balaam at the end of it. I mean, this is really, really, really pricey. And what happens? Nothing happens at the end of the day. Even after all of this, there's no guarantee that it's going to work. Notice in chapter 23 and verse 3, the very first time, what Balaam says is, "Stand beside your burnt offering, and I will go. Perhaps the Lord will come to meet me, and whatever he shows me, I will tell you." You have no guarantee God's going to say anything, and you have no guarantee that it's going to be what you want him to say. When you are substituting, you're taking God out and substituting something false in its place, you can have zero certainty that it will do anything good for you, and in reality, you can have complete certainty that it will do nothing good for you. If it does anything, it'll do bad for you, is what it will do. And then finally, they're powerless. I mean, absolutely, completely powerless. Balaam is the most famous prophet for hire in the Near East, and he's completely incapable of cursing Israel. I mean, even when the stakes are lowered to it only being a little piece of Israel that he's looking at, still can't do anything. And not only is it powerless, it's counterproductive. Instead of cursing Israel, he repeatedly blesses them. Balaam tries to send him away, and what does he do? He gives him some freebies on top of it. You think you're sending me away? Well, here's four more short oracles for you, Balak. I'll tell you more about how great these people are going to be and how they're going to, you know, wipe out all of their enemies. And the same problems that you see in the Balaam story and the Balak story with these spiritual counterfeits, we see today as well. Whether it's prophets or psychics or other sorts of substitutes. It's grandiose claims of offering you everything, the promise of substantial rewards if you'll just devote your life to this thing, and instead they wind up being expensive, uncertain, and powerless. I really like the way Duguid talks about this. I got a quote here for you to think about. He says, "The power that we ascribe to these idols that we've set up for ourselves is evident in the way we pour ourselves so devotedly into pursuing their demands and are so wrapped up in fears of their loss. We would willingly go to the end of the earth to do their bidding, and we regularly sacrifice on their altars whatever they demand. They fill our dreams and our nightmares, and they shape our expenditures and our relationships. They are profoundly expensive masters, both in financial terms and in terms of the turmoil they create in our souls. Yet in the end, like all idols, they are impotent to deliver what they promise or threaten." I mean, the more we can get our mind around looking at whatever false god it is that we're tempted to serve and seeing this in it, the less tempting those things will be. I almost wish I'd put this up at the beginning and we could just reflect on this, because there is so much good stuff that he's saying here. But then finally, as I mentioned earlier, this appeal that he has to dying the death of the righteous, he doesn't. And I'll just say briefly that there is a really easy path to dying the death of the righteous, and it's living the life of the righteous, joining the righteous in your lifetime. And Balaam has no interest in that. He doesn't look down at Israel and see how blessed they are and go live with them. What he does is he goes to the Midianites and dies with them. Greg?
Just these last two slides, it'll be interesting next week, contrasting these last two slides with the next chapter.
Yes. Because what you're going to see is Israel plummeting into their own sin. So, that'll be 2 weeks. Next week will be our song service. If my calendar's straight in my head. Is my calendar straight in my head?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, so next week will be our song service, and we'll be in Numbers 25 next time, and that should just be that one chapter.